Hi, I'm Lisa Davis. Welcome to It's Your Health. A few weeks ago, the king of pot, Michael Jackson, died. Speculation is that he died from mixing prescription drugs. How common is prescription drug use for non-medical reasons? The statistics are baffling. 33 million Americans have admitted to using prescription painkillers non-medically. 7 million Americans are currently abusing prescription drugs. 1 in 10 high school seniors admits to abusing prescription painkillers. It is important to learn about these stats. However, it is even more important to find a way to connect to them in a personal way. Joshua Lyon, author of the new book, Pillhead, The Secret Life of a Painkiller Addict, which is available today, July 7th, is just a book to make the stats real and meaningful to everyone who reads it. Joshua Lyon is a journalist who has worked for several major publications, including Interview, Condé Nast, Traveler, V Life, and Jane. He has also contributed to New York, Out, Vice, and Page Six magazines. Pillhead is his first of what I hope will be many books. Joshua, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks so much.
Now, first off, I want to know, how is your grandmother, Bobby, doing?
She's doing great. I'm going to see her in a couple of weeks. We're going to meet up in Ocean Isle, which is a little island off the coast of South Carolina.
Oh, that sounds nice. So when everyone goes and gets a book, they'll know what I'm talking about. I won't give any more away. And I want to say, you know, I was really moved by your story. And you wrote about some pretty harrowing times in your life with such candor. How did it feel to be that open?
It was really cathartic. I mean, I think anytime something kind of rough has gone on in my life, I've tend to try and write about it to try and make sense of it. And that was actually the reason why I wanted to write the book, is that when I was in the middle of my addiction, I couldn't really find any good memoir first-person accounts of anybody else who was really going through anything else that I was going through. There were a lot of books about the pharmaceutical industry and, you know, their people saying how evil they were, but there was nothing really that explained what it felt like to be on pills and really made sense. I needed somebody to make me feel like I wasn't the only one who was alone, you know?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now, you mentioned that you first tried illegal drugs at 13, and you write that you're an expert at escapism. And obviously, I would assume that's a big part of your desire to try drugs. And what, not to get too personal, but was it just things, was there anything in general you were trying to escape from, or just hard family times, or just the overwhelmingness of life?
Yeah, pretty much. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, I think everyone can say they've had, you know, crazy childhood at some point, and I definitely had, you know, a rough childhood too. It was a lot of that, and I think I'm just, for some reason, I've always been overly sensitive, and it's something I've always known about myself. You know, things tend to affect me really strongly. You know, if I'm angry, I'm like furious. If I'm like sad, it's this deep, deep, deep depression, and drugs always seem like a way to kind of level that playing field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people, when you say that, you know, we had spoken previously, which was really nice, and I was, you know, saying that a lot of people in my family are like that, including my daughter, and it's just, you know, when people feel things so deeply, it's really hard to deal with. So I can understand your desire to try to, like you said, even that out.
Yeah, it's like you need a filter for the rest of the world almost.
Yeah, I completely understand. Now, from the age of 13 into your 20s, you partied pretty regularly. And you wrote that you first took prescription drugs when you were writing a story about them for Jane magazines. But the fact that you had been partying a lot, had that ever come up before? Had anyone offered you prescription drugs prior to the magazine article?
It had just actually started happening in that past, like, year or so that I'd started hearing people talk about Vicodin. You know, it was kind of just, you know, hearing it from, like, the sides, you know, people mentioning like, oh, I'm going to go home and take a Vicodin, never really equated it to this kinds of, you know, regular party drugs that I was doing. Mm-hmm. Up until that point, I definitely tried like Valium and Xanax. You know, people had handed that out to me before. Like, you know, if I'd been doing cocaine, you know, I would be given a Valium and said like, oh, this will help you sleep tonight. Never really felt what those felt like because I would always take them while I was on something else and it would just kind of knock me out, which is incredibly dangerous. Don't anyone try that.
Don't try this at home.
Yeah.
Definitely not.
So yeah, that actually contributed to the reason why I wanted to do that initial article for Jane, because I had started hearing, you know, people talk about it. I wanted to see what all the fuss was about.
And you found out some pretty startling things. I mean, didn't you say that you not only could you get prescriptions online, but they would call you to renew, like, if you hadn't called them back?
Oh, they still call me to this day.
Oh, my God. Leave them alone.
Yeah, totally.
The heck?
Yeah, that's actually something that got cut from the book, is that it's frustrating because I don't want to change my phone number because I like, there's something about the way the numbers roll off my tongue. I have a nice sequence of numbers, so I don't want to change it. But yeah, it's frustrating. Usually I can usually tell when one's coming up, so I just, hit ignore.
So you did this article and you basically found out how easy it was to get the drugs online. But then after a while, that got a little bit tougher, didn't it?
It did, and the reason why is because the DEA got wise to what was going on, and they started shutting down internet pharmacies. But what would happen is they could, trace the organizations back to where it was coming from, but then what would happen is they would just pop up somewhere else. The organization would be able to pop up in another location and start their business up again. So sometimes what would happen is, a pharmacy that I was ordering from would disappear, and then they would call me back, 6 months later and be like, oh, hey, we're up in business. Or if I was looking, I would just, Google again, do a Google search and just find another company that was selling what I was looking for.
Oh, my gosh. Now, if you couldn't get it from there, you would get it. There were people just like selling other drugs on the street or through clubs. You can get them that way as well.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of an evolution. After, as soon as the pharmacy started to dry up more and more, what I would do is, it was embarrassingly enough, it was as simple as like doing, posting bulletins on MySpace, like, hey, anybody got any Vicodin to sell? And also Craigslist, doing searches on Craigslist, and it worked. I don't think would ever fly these days. Back then it was still, people weren't really realizing how much of a problem.
Now, when you say back then, that was like what, early 2000s?
Yeah, early 2000s. And for all I know, it was probably going on earlier than that, too. That's just when I discovered it. I mean, basically what happened is once the internet hit and became like, a tool used by everybody, I mean, any kind of business, like, drugs, porn, they all exploded just because there was this way of reaching out to people that had never been seen before.
Now, I know that some people, might have, like I had had, minor surgery, so I had some Vicodin, and I would take it and it helped the pain. And, but then there's other times where I just couldn't sleep. And I was like, oh, I have some left over, but I never had them in like a partying way. To me, it was just more, but still, you talk about that there was different types, that there was a doctor that you interviewed, and Dr. Boyd, and there's four main types of pill users: medical misusers, medicine abusers, prescription drug misusers, and prescription drug abusers. And I think I was one of those, and it kind of freaked me out. Although I wasn't out partying, but it's like, oh God, I'm really stressed. Or, when my mother died, my father gave me a Valium that night to help me sleep.
Yeah.
And it really helped. And then my boyfriend at the time, he basically made me flush them all down the toilet because he's like, you're really depressed. Yeah, I know. He's like, you're really depressed. I don't, think this is what's going to happen, but, this is a big loss. And I was 28 at the time. And he's like, I'm just getting rid of them. And I was mad. I'm like, but I need to sleep. And he's like, you know what? You're going to have to deal. Go to a support group, do something else. And I've always been I was never into partying or anything. I was pretty clean, open-minded, but pretty clean cut type of gal. And so it was just kind of funny. I'm like, what do you think is going to happen? He's like, I ain't taking any chances. But anyway, it's that sadness though. It can really, but anyway, so I had, so luckily I wasn't out selling them. I flushed them down the toilet, but apparently some people must be, if you're getting them off Craigslist, right?
Exactly. And basically those four types. Yes. Definitely were one of them. the reason why I like the way that Dr. Carol Boyd breaks those groups up is because there's actually a lot of there are a lot of numbers out there. I think even in your introduction you talked about that there's two sets of numbers. There are the people that have, are currently abused. There are the people that have tried, messing around non-medically, and that number is much larger because I think a lot of people have done exactly what you just described.
Mm-hmm.
You have some leftover, you try it. And what happens is that worst case scenario, say they hadn't been flushed down the toilet, they could have sat around in your medicine cabinet for a long time. Somebody like a friend, or, God forbid, if, as your daughter got older, they could have come along, not know what exactly they were, hear about these kinds of drugs at school, just hear like, Valium's like something fun. And that's another one of the common ways these drugs do get diverted is, people leave them around because they don't respond to them very well initially. So, if they have them for a wisdom teeth removal, they'll take a couple. They feel nauseous. They leave them around and they get pilfered.
Okay. Now, so the metal, so which was it? So there's a medical misuser. Isn't that the one where you have it and you're not using it? Like you have some sort of legitimate reason or some kind of injury, but then you don't take it the right way, or you take too many more than you're supposed to?
I think the analogy she used to say, you have a wisdom teeth taken out. The doctor tells you to take one every 6 hours, but if at night the pain is really, really bad, so you take two or three.
For
2 or 3 hours. So that would just be a medical misuser. And honestly, I think that's a really common category.
Exactly.
I mean, even with something like Advil, I think people do that all the time. The second group, medicine abusers. So, that's somebody who has, a legitimate prescription for, say, Vicodin or Valium, but they're saving them when they're left over, and then you take them recreationally every now and then when you want to go out to a party. And so that's considered a medicine abuser because that's abuse. It's not a form of, self-treatment, which is what the medical misusers are trying to do. And
the prescription drug misusers?
Yeah, that's, say, this would be, say, that you had that Vicodin and a friend of yours came over and they were complaining about, a bad headache, and you gave that away to your friend. You're basically, what you're doing, it seems so casual, but what you're really doing is you're diverting a medication illegally.
Doesn't
have their own prescription. So, and again, that's another thing that's really, really, really common. And people just don't, I think, even realize that what they're doing is something that's basically, illegal and really, really potentially dangerous.
I mean, I'm sure and I feel bad if my dad's listening. He's probably like, I just knew you were upset about your mother. I took it out.
Oh, no.
Now there's prescription drug abusers, and that's what you were doing.
That's me.
That's you.
That was me.
That was you.
The one who's, you're stealing or buying diverted pills, from either, drug dealers or friends or family or MySpace, or online, with the specific intent to get high. And, going back to what I mentioned earlier, I think the reason why she breaks these people up into the different categories is to get a better, kind of a more realistic idea of the numbers of people that are doing these things. I mean, because the numbers have changed even. The numbers that I state in the book, in Pillhead, I think it was when I finished writing the book, I had the most current numbers from Dawn, the Drug Abuse Warning Network.
That was
35 million Americans. And the latest numbers that I've seen now from the National Institute on Drug Abuse, it's 48 million.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I just took it from you. I was going to give you credit, by the way. I got those from you. Oh, my goodness.
And, this is people who, but the thing is, so what they're doing is, so they're saying 48 million people have used prescription drugs for non-medical reasons in their lifetime. So what they're doing is, that number is really high, but they're kind of lumping those four categories together. But I think that's still an accurate representation, because what can happen is that, if somebody is a medical misuser, which is that first category, I mean, it's not a very far jump to go from that to a prescription drug abuser.
Yeah. So I was going to say that. I mean, I think, I remember hearing about Matthew Perry, that guy from Friends, that he had some back injury or something, and all of a sudden he's in rehab, Rush Limbaugh, this whole OxyContin thing. And it's just so prevalent. But, I want to get back to your feelings that you had when you were on Vicodin. On the cover of your book, it actually says, I was feeling no pain. I cared about nothing but this 3 Vicodin. That was all it took. I was in love. Now, you figured out that this was the escape. We talked about how you like to escape. This was the effect that helped kind of balance things out for you. And how soon did you know that that was it and you were just going to keep going?
Oh, it was instantaneous. I mean, it was, wow. Yeah.
It was, that was it.
It was literally that first day. It was so intense. I mean, you know, as you said before, I definitely had partied a lot before. I tried so many different drugs, and, like, pot made me feel paranoid. Mm-hmm. You know, cocaine, you just feel, you know, crazy and then completely depressed the next day, like a really, really awful deep depression. Even alcohol, you know, you just get sloppy, and then you have a terrible hangover the next day. And with these pills, it was really, at first, what it felt like was that it was just a pure physical feeling. Like, it didn't feel at first like it was affecting, like, my mind or my thought process at all. Mm-hmm. It was just this really wonderful, warm sensation, and I could still think clearly. I could still function. I could, you know, wander around. I could go out. I could talk to people, feel really, like, brave, feel really handsome, feel... I just felt incredible. So, you know, when you ask if it blew me away. Yeah, it totally did.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, when did this change from this is wonderful, I'm warm, to this is my life is just not what I want it to be, and I'm not feeling well, and I have to lie? And, like, when did the dark side come in, you know?
Yeah, the first time that really happened is it's kind of a time period that I sort of gloss over at the beginning of the book, because the part, my story really starts when I moved back to New York, which is a little bit later in my life after I discovered it. After that first year of discovering Vicodin, I took them pretty regularly for about a year, and it really was towards, I'd say, like, the last half of that first year that things started getting really out of control. And I think that was a combination of just really intense, bad, like, personal events, you know, bad relationships, coupled with, you know, me taking more and more of these pills to escape. And the more you take them, basically, the longer you take them, the harder it is to get that initial, like, great, wonderful feeling. And all of a sudden, you find yourself stuck taking them to, like, chase that feeling. And yet, you don't have really ever quite reach it. What I hadn't discovered at that point is that, you know, in order to get that feeling back, what you have to do is then take other stronger opiates on top of that.
Oh.
I hadn't quite discovered that yet. That's something that came later in my life. But yeah, it happened fairly quickly. I mean, I would say after, like, the first, like, 6 months of using them pretty regularly, I definitely knew this was not the right path for me to be going down.
Wow. Now, before we get into, because I do want to talk about rehab, because the time goes so fast. We have about 10 minutes. I wanted to mention that. Is that crazy? We can talk for hours. You got to come back. I'm telling you right now. Anyway, you write about, I think it was 4 other people who are also painkiller addicts in the book.
Huh?
And how did you pick those particular people? Did you speak to more than that? Or were those just the ones that, you know, really stood out?
It was almost like a casting call in a strange way. I spoke to a lot of people who were addicted, and I found them through friends of friends. You know, even I searched through newspaper articles from other cities and found, you know, people who had been, like, arrested or been in trouble with the law, and then just contacted them that way. But basically what I wanted to do is pick people that had found their way into this addiction through different entry points.
Yeah.
I wanted to show that there are so many different kinds of ways that people can get addicted to them. So you have Heather, who was prescribed painkillers legitimately when she was in the hospital for a collapsed lung and then got out and found that she, you know, missed them. You have Jared, who had a friend who worked at a drugstore and was, like, just stealing directly from his drugstore. You have, I'm still, you know, I have everybody's real names in my head, and I'm so scared of accidentally.
Oh, I should have written them down, because I know there was Heather, there was Jared, I don't remember the other names.
Caleb,
that was it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then you have Caleb, whose first, like, big score came from from a truck that was, you know, hijacked, you know, a truck that was leaving a distribution facility and was hijacked. And then, you know, when that supply ran out, he ended up going down to Mexico because he lived, you know, near the border and was able to get down there fairly easily to buy, like, his medications over the border and then smuggle them back. So, yeah, and it's basically I basically wanted to show people who got the drugs in very different ways.
Yeah, that's what I was going to, you know, compliment you on, is that it made it interesting, because your story is so moving on its own, but then to have the other stories as well, and I say, wow, people from all walks of life and all different ages and, you know, whatever you're man, woman, whatever, you know, so that was really interesting. But I wanted to mention that you had interviewed a lot of interesting people. And one of the ones that I really enjoyed reading about was Joseph Califano Jr., the chair and president of the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. And he talks about the ineffectiveness of the anti-drug programs like DARE. And he believes that an effective anti-drug program in the schools would need to be tailored to the individual's needs and the needs of the communities. And I totally agree. When I was in graduate school, there was a guy who actually did a paper on basically how DARE is completely ineffective. I know he talks about that too. And another thing is, I was a teenager in the 80s when the Just Say No, you know, the whole thing with Nancy Reagan was a huge anti-drug campaign. And I laughed out loud when you wrote about your mom giving you that Just Say No button when you were nine and you're thinking this is total bull, you know what? And I thought, yeah, but this actually also, I wanted to talk about harm reduction and how when I was getting my master's in public health, I took a class in harm reduction and I did an internship at the Needle Exchange. This was in Hawaii. And then I also came back to California before I came here and worked in a needle exchange there. If you can tell us a little bit about harm reduction and your feelings about that.
Yeah, I mean, the basic principle around harm reduction is that I mean, it's basically to save lives in any way possible. And I think the idea is that, you know, there are certainly a lot of people who are still addicted to drugs. They're not necessarily ready emotionally to, you know, get clean. But that doesn't mean that they should be treated as second-class citizens in any way. I mean, these are people that are suffering from something very real. And what harm reduction does is teaches them ways to use drugs safely in a way that basically will keep them from dying, which I think is, you know, the number one most important thing. And one way that really helps with painkillers and actually in heroin as well, that, you know, because it's chemically very similar, opiates, is to get access to a drug called naloxone, which is a medication that's you inject it if someone is overdosing in front of you on an opiate, and what it does is it just knocks the opiates directly off of your receptors, and it can bring somebody back from an overdose and cause them to start breathing again. And what I say in the book is I feel like anybody who's messing around with painkillers, anyone who even knows somebody who's using painkillers, should really go to a local harm reduction center and get trained on how to use these injection kits. Because basically, if you have a friend or a child who's allergic to peanuts, you're going to carry around one of those, I think they're called EpiPens, you know, to bring them back from an allergic reaction. And I really don't see any difference between the two in my mind, because hopefully what I would think would happen is if somebody does get brought back from an overdose, that might be the one, you know, great chance in their life that they can be like, oh, wait a minute, I really need help. Maybe this is my, I should get clean. This is a huge thing that just happened to me. Maybe I need to, like, start turning my life around.
Exactly. Well, I was going to say, too, I mean, that's what I saw working at the Needle Exchange, is that, you know, you get to know people, they get to trust you, and then you have some brochures around on getting help, and then they're like, oh, that looks interesting. You know what I mean? Like, it kind of opens the door where people think, oh, you're just, you know, helping these people take more drugs. Like, no, I'm trying to stop the spread of HIV. Thank you very much. I used to be a hepatitis C educator at a methadone clinic and at a rehab center. You know, no, I want to help people and they need help. And, you know, I saw when you build that trust and you're not treating them like dirt, like so many people do, then it makes a big difference. Now, talking about rehab, when did you finally decide to go? And if you don't want to give away too much in the book, you know, you don't have to tell me what was the final straw, but, you know, I mean, what had you thought about going previous to when you finally went, or was this just, okay, I'm going to go?
I had thought about it. I was really, really resistant to the idea. And to be honest, the excuse I used is that I couldn't leave my cat alone for a month. I didn't leave my cat, which ended up working out fine in the end because my friends all took care of him.
Oh, that's
good. The final straw was just a letter. It was a letter that I got from a really close friend who, it was the language that she used. She came at me from not in an attacking way, but this really kind of just, she was heartbroken over seeing like what I had become. And, you know, the line that really hit me is she told me that she thought the light was going out of my eyes. And that terrified me because I knew exactly what she was talking about. And it was literally just it was her language with that that's what convinced me finally. And so I think that's good advice for anybody who you know, is trying to talk to somebody who has a drug problem is that, like, it's really, really good to come at it from a place of, like, love and caring and not any kind of, like, accusatory way, because that's just going to make anybody who's doing drugs, like, clam right up and try and cut you out of their life. Mm-hmm. So don't give, I mean, I just want to say this to people, like, don't give up on anybody who's addicted to drugs. It really, you know, if you love them and care about them, stay with them and just keep letting them know that you're there for them and that you care about them and that you want them to get help.
So do you think an intervention is good if it's done with love and you're approaching it the right way? Like if you get a group of friends or family or together
and sit down with
someone, or do you think that can be too overwhelming?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I used to totally not believe in them. I used to think that was horrible. And I do, because as a drug addict, I knew that I would never respond to that. And even now, back then, when I think back, I don't think I would have responded to it. But what I think people need to realize is that if they do an intervention and it fails, because to be honest, I think a lot of the time they do, don't give up on it. And I think what happens is people get so discouraged after an intervention that they just kind of like give up and they like stop, you know, trying to get help for that person for like, you know, 6 months or a year, and then maybe try again a year later. But just keep at it, you know, let them know that you really, really care. And don't, if one fails, then, you know, give it a small amount of time, but try again and try again, but always come at it from a place of love. Yeah. Instead of, you know, anger.
Oh yeah. Now you had friends that knew, but your family didn't. You said your family didn't know until you finally went to rehab, right?
Not at all. You know, it's funny though. My, I kept it from them, and it was pretty easy to keep from them. I think I don't see them very often, you know, which I think was one of the bigger factors there. But I was on Good Morning America recently, and they had asked me to describe some of the signs that people and, you know, as I was listing all the things that you can look for, apparently my little niece and nephew turned to my older sister, and they were like, oh my God, Uncle Josh used to do that all the time. We totally remember him scratching himself and acting all weird and spacey. So they were on to me, but no one else.
And memory loss is one too, right?
Yeah, that's something I'm honestly still struggling with, especially, you know, even giving interviews.
Is that long-term memory or short-term memory, like things that happened when you were young or things that are going on now? Or
it's both. I mean, it's both a lot of short-term memory, but I mean, I've always had a hard time remembering things from when I was little, and now this just makes it like worse, but everyone keeps telling me that it's going to come back, so.
Now, in the last minute or so, how do you feel now? How are you feeling strong? Do you feel confident? Are you enjoying what you're doing?
I am. I do. I got to say, I was really, really scared about a month ago about the idea of going back out into the world and talking really openly about this, mainly just because when you're talking about how painkillers feel, to be honest, I miss it. There's still a part of me that does miss the feelings, but you know, there's no way I would go back to them, and that's the other thing that's been really great, is to just like keep talking about all the really horrible effects as well, and that's what's really keeping me
good. Well, I think you're great, and I don't want you going back. So I'm like, I don't know. That's it. I'm telling you right now. But anyway, I want to have you back on the show in a few months again, because you're so wonderful. And your book is Pillhead, The Secret Life of a Painkiller Addict. And it's out today, Joshua Lyon. And it's just, I just feel so honored that I got to speak with you on the day that your book is coming out. I just want to thank you so much. And I want to let everyone know that in a few days, the interview will be up on my site, itsyourhealthradio.org. And if you want to email me, lisa@itsyourhealthradio.org. Starting next week, it's exciting. We're going to have two shows. Except for the first Tuesday of the month, the rest of the month on Tuesdays, we're going to have a show from 9:30 to 10 and 10 to 10:30. Next week, we're going to have Mark Reinfeld, who is the author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Eating Raw Foods. And we're also going to have Bethany Frankel, who is the creator of Bethany Bakes. She's also on Bravo's hit TV show, The Real Housewives of New York City. And she wrote a book called Naturally Thin. And she's a lot of fun. So listen next week. Joshua, take care. Have fun today with your book. And I'm going to tell everyone. And thank you so much for coming on. I think you're awesome.
Thank you. You are too.
Thanks. Bye.
Hey.